You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Overlord's Underdog by Tom Doughton, with photographs by Ryan Pfluger. It soon became clear why Kastner had answered his letter. The producer was drowning in lawsuits from people claiming he double-crossed them or owed them money. Next, he tried his hand at producing an indie film, Sons, with Jennifer Beals, and directed by her then-husband. To find a distributor, he went to Cannes during the film festival and paid kids to plaster the closet with posters at 4 a.m. Toberoff says the movie got distribution, barely. He then moved out to Los Angeles with Dahlia. One day, while walking on the treadmill and looking at the back of the Hollywood Reporter for a place to rent, he saw a listing from the son of a famous writer who was seeking a manager. Toberoff reached out. The son, a hippie who told the lawyer he used to drop acid but quit when he saw Neil Armstrong land on the moon, handed him a messy box of papers from his father. The old man, it turned out, had co-wrote The Marx Brothers, A Day at the Races, and I Married a Witch, which influenced the TV series Bewitched. Leafing through the papers, Toberoff saw he'd also created Combat, a 1960s World War II TV series about GIs. In the box was a letter saying the writer was owed $327 related to something called separated rights. Scanning deeper, Toberoff discovered a provision in the Writers Guild collective bargaining agreement that says writers who create original TV series automatically retain certain rights, including film rights, that supersedes any other agreement. By pure coincidence, a week later, he read a story in Variety that Capital Cities ABC was making a combat movie starring Bruce Willis. He fired off a letter to the studio on newly created stationery, telling them they didn't have the theatrical film rights. Their lawyers responded with a longer letter, including the full contract, and pointing to the paragraph where his client's father had waived his separated rights. I've since learned that the hardest thing to get is the old contract, and little information goes a long way with me, Toberoff says. He told the lawyers that the paragraph showed a concerted effort by the studio to circumvent the WGA contract by pressuring his client's father to waive his separated rights in order to get the job, which violated the collective bargaining agreement. And besides, his client's father couldn't waive those rights anyway because he was only a beneficiary of the guild contract, not a party to it. The only parties were the studio and the guild, so only the guild could waive the rights, and the guild never had, which meant the separated rights reverted to his client. The studio's lawyers told him to come in for a meeting. Toberoff put on a suit and tie and showed up at a Century City legal office where the studio offered to settle. Toberoff countered, and when he saw in their eyes that they were going to take it, quickly added that he wanted to be a producer. They go, "Wait a minute, you're a lawyer, you can't be a producer." And I go, "No, it's the other way around. I had to go to law school." But anyone, it turns out, can be a producer. Combat never got made. Saving Private Ryan was greenlit around the same time, sinking the competing World War II project. But Toberoff's career as a producer copyright attorney was born. He developed a system. He tracked the rights of old TV shows and films from eras when creators often retained rights. He'd cold call the writers of properties like My Favorite Martian or track down their heirs. He'd offer to examine their contracts, looking for angles. When he found an inn, he'd pitch revival projects around town. And when a studio said yes, take a cut. In Hollywood, no one had really done what he had done with copyright law, multiple agents and producers agree. Sometimes writers would come to him. In 2004, he got a call from Guy Waldron, creator of The Dukes of Hazzard. After Warner Brothers announced it was going to make it into a movie starring Jessica Simpson, the studio assumed they had the rights sewn up. Toberoff discovered that before it was a series, it had been a movie called Moonrunners, which he argued gave Waldron part of the rights. Toberoff asked them to settle for $1.25 million, but they waved him away and went ahead with production. He sued and got a judge to take the almost unheard-of action of issuing a preliminary injunction ahead of the release. Faced with the possibility of federal marshals seizing film canisters, Warner Brothers agreed to settle. He told the studio's general counsel his number. "I want two chai," which either means "I want your two firstborn children," or it means 36. In Hebrew numerology, chai means life and equals 18. So two chai by his math is $36 million. Warner Brothers reportedly settled for $17.5 million, or just above one chai. The first line of Variety was, "Chalk one up for the little guy," Toberoff says. "That case made me known at all the studios." He's gotten involved in even more entangled pieces of IP, including working with the descendants of the creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. The two had created the character as teenagers, but parted with the rights in 1938. When they tried in court to reclaim them in 1947, they lost. They lived their lives in the shadow of Superman, Toberoff says. The daughter described how they used to eat Spam for dinner and didn't partake in any of the profits. Everybody else became filthy rich. Toberoff took on the case in the early 2000s and won back Siegel's half of the Superman copyright for his family. Warner Brothers countersued Toberoff personally, claiming he stood to gain as a financial participant in the Superman copyright. That case was dismissed, but the litigation between the Shuster heirs and the studio is ongoing. He's also worked for the family of Jack Kirby, one of the key early artists for Marvel Comics. After losing rulings in lower courts, Toberoff petitioned the Supreme Court, which he says was on the verge of taking on a case that would have re-examined work for hire under the Copyright Act of 1909. Disney settled for an undisclosed amount in 2014. That obsessiveness has become his defining trait. He's literally the Rockford Files. This guy sitting out there in Malibu, says Stuart Manishill, a talent manager and producer who's worked with Toberoff on projects like an upcoming remake of 1988's cult classic martial arts film, Bloodsport, an adaptation of the book the 1987 psychological thriller Angel Heart was based on, and a TV series, Crystal Lake, based on the Friday the 13th movies. He's not in a trailer, but he's in an office, and it's him and an assistant, and he'll just keep going. "When I originally started doing this with IP in Hollywood, it was like, 'Toberoff, you're a bottom feeder.' And I would say, 'Yeah, I'll see you down there,'" he says, adding that he has a full team working for him. Things changed as the streaming era took off, and companies loaded up on well-known properties. His ability to untangle the rights for content, allowing it to be made, became a valuable currency. Producers and writers increasingly viewed Toberoff as a resource in a complicated legal landscape. "When he started doing it, it was like total outsider," says Manishill. I think that more and more places now see the value in dealing with him, evidenced by the number of deals he has. They need the IP. Or, as Toberoff puts it, it went from bottom feeder to Toberoff, player, what do you got? Let's make a deal. A few years ago, he secured the U.S. rights to 1988's Beetlejuice for one of the film's living co-writers and the estate of the other. He then reached out to Mike Simpson, agent for director Tim Burton. Burton, who'd been waffling for years on whether to make a sequel, agreed to do it. Followed by original cast members including Michael Keaton, Winona Ryder, and Catherine O'Hara. Beetlejuice 2024 made more than $400 million at the box office, with Toberoff credited as a producer. It drives these studios crazy. They just can't believe that there's this guy out there that can actually impact them that much, Simpson says. From the artist point of view, he's a godsend. To the studios, he's something else entirely. Terrorist, one executive suggests. Toberoff's maximalist negotiating style makes working with him impossible, multiple executives say. Despite Toberoff having clients who control desirable properties like A Nightmare on Elm Street, some would rather not make a movie than work with him. Sometimes, when a studio wants to remake an old movie or TV show and the business affairs team discovers his name attached to one of the parties, the train screeches to a halt. In many places, it dies right there, one executive explains. Phone conversation over, pursuit of it over. Few from the studios would go on the record discussing Toberoff. As one put it, life's too short. They say their frustration isn't about paying rights holders. Studios expect that. What galls them is Toberoff's tooth and nail negotiations and his insistence on becoming a producer himself, complete with credit and fees. It's not the first time we've seen this kind of desire for people who really want to be in show business, one executive says. It's their way in. Marischal sees the studio resistance differently. As Hollywood's traditional power structure has weakened, he argues, Toberoff's leverage has only grown. The pushback, he believes, stems from executives' anxiety about their diminishing control and having to pay the creators for whom Toberoff is getting the rights. Everybody in Hollywood's insecure. As a studio exec, a huge part of the job is to exploit the library of IP. And then there's Mark, who can stand in the way. Of course, they're not going to like that. Still, even as Manischel admits, Toberoff can be exhausting. He has that litigator thing where everything is a fight, and sometimes you're like, dude, let's just take the deal. But he's proven me wrong on multiple occasions and gotten better terms. Toberoff shrugs at the studio backlash. When they have rights, they exploit every inch of those rights and even sue each other over those rights, he says. So it's all about whose rice bowl is getting pissed in. Emmanuel was more emphatic about studio complaints over Toberoff's demand to be a producer. There's a lot of effing producers that don't deserve credit. Who gives a shit? In early 2024, Toberoff got a call from Emmanuel. It was about Elon Musk. Emmanuel had been friends with the Tesla CEO for more than 15 years, since buying an early Roadster. I just don't like driving a Prius, he says. In February, Musk filed a lawsuit against Altman and OpenAI through the firm Ayrle and Manila, citing breach of contract. One Saturday, he called Emmanuel while the agent was at the Riviera Country Club in the Pacific Palisades, and the two chatted about the case. Musk wanted a second opinion, and Emmanuel told him to bring Toberoff on. He looks at things differently than other lawyers, Emmanuel says. When you're not billing hourly, you get really creative about how to think about the law. Refiled with Toberoff running legal strategy, the lawsuit now frames the OpenAI story as a shared vision turned secret betrayal. In 2015, Altman pitched Musk on creating OpenAI as a nonprofit Manhattan Project for AI to counter Google's dominance. Musk, who'd been publicly warning about AI as an existential threat to humanity, agreed to fund it. He contributed more than $44 million over 5 years and recruited key talent, including its chief scientist, Ilya Sutskever, the lawsuit says. By 2017, Altman and co-founder Greg Brockman had suggested converting to a for-profit to raise outside money. Musk refused. Either go do something on your own or continue with OpenAI as a nonprofit, he wrote to them, according to the lawsuit. I will no longer fund OpenAI until you have made a firm commitment to stay, or I'm just being a fool who is essentially providing free funding to a startup. Altman reassured him they remained enthusiastic about the nonprofit structure. But in 2019, they created a for-profit arm with Altman as CEO and raised $1 billion from Microsoft. In the succeeding years, OpenAI would raise billions of dollars, release ChatGPT, raise tens of billions more, fire and then reinstate Altman over 5 days, redo the board with members that were allied with the CEO, and reach a $500 billion valuation. Meanwhile, Musk launched a competitive AI firm called xAI, but his feelings over the fallout with Altman nagged at him. The core of his allegation is that the CEO built a company ostensibly as a nonprofit with his money and then conspired against him with Brockman by turning it into a for-profit for their personal gain. Key to their argument are personal files that Brockman kept, where he jotted down his private thoughts about Musk, the company, and the nonprofit conversion. They were obtained as part of legal discovery. Okay, so what do I really want? Brockman writes in one entry. And around the word really, he puts two asterisks. According to court documents, mulling over his goals and potential for the company. Later, he adds, this is the only chance we have to get out from Elon. Is he the glorious leader that I would pick? We truly have a chance to make this happen. Financially, what will take me to $1 billion? In another note, cannot say that we are committed to the nonprofit. Don't want to say that we're committed. If 3 months later we're doing B Corp, then it was a lie. Toberoff, who calls the files Brockman's diary, says they are basically a confessional as to everything we're saying. OpenAI's version is that Altman, Brockman, and Musk all agreed that the company needed a for-profit structure, with Musk even suggesting they attach Tesla to the company as its cash cow, according to an OpenAI legal filing. When that plan fell through, Musk stormed out. Not over the nonprofit issue, OpenAI argues, but because he believed its chance of reaching superintelligence was zero. OpenAI is on a path of certain failure relative to Google, Musk wrote in an email in January 2018, a part of the court documents. There obviously needs to be immediate and dramatic action, or everyone except for Google will be consigned to irrelevance. He resigned from the board a month later. In March 2019, OpenAI created its capped profit subsidiary. The company's legal rebuttal says Toberoff's case cherry-picks key information, leaving out important context, showing that Musk was aware of and endorsed a conversion. The rest is just bitterness on the Tesla founder's part, once the company became a rocket ship without him. Altman has laid out his response on X. I helped turn the thing you left for dead into what should be the largest nonprofit ever. You know as well as anyone a structure like what OpenAI has now is required to make that happen. Privately, The two tried to mend fences for a time. In a February 2023 email revealed during discovery, Altman pleaded with Musk to stop attacking the company. "I remember seeing you in a TV interview a long time ago, maybe 60 Minutes, where you're being attacked by some guys, and you said they were heroes of yours, and it was really tough. Well, you're my hero, and that's what it feels like when you attack OpenAI." Musk responded, "I hear you, and it is certainly not my intention to be hurtful, for which I apologize, but the fate of civilization is at stake." Toberoff says he was drawn to the case partly on moral grounds that Altman really had defrauded a charity. He also was concerned about the existential threat of AI. But he admits he wanted to be closer to the AI world as the technology swept through Hollywood. Then, of course, there was the drama. "They say Hollywood is like high school with money, and I quickly realized that Silicon Valley is like high school with a lot more money," Toberoff says. He describes himself as coming from an ultra-liberal background, which could put him at odds with Musk politically. But during a visit to Tesla's headquarters, he saw a different side of the man, surrounded by his company's Optimus robots. "These robots would be pacing the halls, and you would stop and talk to them, and they talk to you because they are connected to AI," Toberoff says. "That's where he belongs in that world. That's where he excels. He was just bouncing around." Since taking over, the lawyer has thrown everything at stopping OpenAI's attempt to restructure into a for-profit entity. He's worked hard at spinning the press. He told Reuters that while the case Musk's original legal team had filed was a goldfish, this federal suit was a great white. "In January 2025, Toberoff called me while I was at the Wall Street Journal, having read a story I co-wrote about Altman's increasing conflicts as an investor and his role at OpenAI. Talking to Toberoff in this period was chaotic. On calls, I would hear the ringtone from Signal, the secure messaging app popular with reporters, going off endlessly in the background. He once sent me a text that was probably intended for a New York Times reporter, then immediately followed up with, 'Ignore that last message.' When I'm in these lawsuits, I'm at my desk at 9 o'clock, and I have dinner at 9:30 p.m. And I probably would have dinner later if my wife didn't keep calling me," Toberoff later said for this story. Next photos, tech attack. Elon Musk and Sam Altman in conversation with New York Times columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin at the Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit in 2016. As with his Hollywood work, he tried to wrest back control of the process with a close reading of the law. Last February, he submitted yet another letter, this one to the Attorneys General of California and Delaware, which governs nonprofits in their state, saying they have a duty to ensure that if a company is converting to a for-profit, the charity's assets are priced at fair market value. They didn't respond, he says. A few weeks later, Toberoff tried to force a determination of that value by bidding on it. XAI announced it was submitting a $974 billion bid to buy OpenAI that was backed by Musk, along with several other investors, including Valor Equity Partners, Emmanuel, and other frequent partners in his financial adventurism. Altman rejected the offer in a post on X. "No, thank you, but we will buy Twitter for $9.74 billion if you want." Musk, replying to another commenter, called him Scam Altman. In May, OpenAI changed tacks. It announced it was no longer going to convert the entire company into a for-profit entity, but instead just transition its for-profit arm into a public benefit corporation. That could still allow them to give investors equity and potentially go public. The company insists it had nothing to do with Toberoff's tactics. Mr. Musk's fake bid did not factor into the company's plans whatsoever, Savitt says. In October, the campaign to stop the restructuring was dealt a blow when the attorneys general in California, where OpenAI is headquartered, and in Delaware, where it's incorporated, approved its new structure. Some nonprofit groups have planned ballot initiatives in California that would undo the AG's decision. The battle lines seem to be forming along industry and geography. Altman has gotten overwhelming support and sympathy from the tech industry, says one person close to OpenAI. OpenAI and Vanity Fair publisher Condé Nast have a multi-year contract that will allow the former to use the latter's content. Most of LA world is super Elon-pilled, this person says. These guys just do whatever Elon wants. OpenAI has tried multiple times to have the suit dismissed. In January, federal judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers, an Obama appointee with a pro-consumer record, denied OpenAI's latest motion to dismiss and sent the case to trial. Opening arguments begin in late April in Oakland. Toberoff was jubilant after the decision. "We kicked ass today," he messaged me. The next day, he sent me a link to a CNBC video clip where David Faber discussed the win for Musk team. In it, Faber read a triumphant statement from Toberoff that the hearing had confirmed their claims about Altman's character. "Now their false faces must hide what their false hearts doth know," Faber read on the air. Once again, Toberoff couldn't resist the Shakespeare, though he seemed in on the joke this time. "It's Saturday Night Live," he messaged me. Nonprofit experts are mixed on the case. He seems to be arguing that the failure to advance the nonprofit purpose is a failure to him, rather than a failure to the public, says Jill Horowitz, a law professor at Northwestern who's followed the case closely. "If OpenAI isn't advancing its nonprofit purpose, that's a harm to the public, not to Elon Musk." The preferred outcome, Toberoff says, would be for the court to force OpenAI to remain a true nonprofit, a result that would effectively unwind its corporate structure and jeopardize tens of billions in investor funding. Failing that, they're seeking disgorgement of wrongful gains that reflect what his stake should be worth, given he was OpenAI's co-founder and primary original investor. Based on their expert analysis, that comes to as much as $134 billion from OpenAI and Microsoft combined, according to their filing. It would be one of the largest damage awards in legal history, roughly 7,400 chai. The money obviously doesn't matter too much to the richest men in the world. The real victory might be the trial itself, where Musk, along with Altman, Brockman, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, and others, will testify about the origins of this company and the question at the heart of Toberoff's complaint, altruism versus greed, and whether the two can ever truly be separated. A few days after the judge's ruling, Toberoff calls me. The high from the OpenAI victory has subsided, and instead he is in a righteous fury about another case he is working on, a Hollywood one. He's been representing Sean Gray, a young screenwriter who says he did uncredited work writing action scenes for Top Gun Maverick, working with his cousin, one of the movie's co-writers. Initially, Gray was only seeking credit from Paramount. When Toberoff took the case, he sued for a share of the profits. But they just suffered a huge blow. A federal judge had dismissed Gray's copyright claims entirely, ruling his scenes were derivative works based on Paramount's IP. Worse, Paramount's fraud and copyright infringement counterclaims, alleging Gray deliberately hid his participation which Gray denies, were greenlit for trial. By countersuing, Paramount was pressuring them to drop the case entirely. There was little for him to gain financially, and with the Musk case now ramping up and billions at stake, he had no time. "They're counting on me just folding. That can never happen," Toberoff says. "I can't bend to this kind of thing. It's literally disgusting." So he'll appeal his case while defending against Paramount's countersuit, which means he'll go to trial against the studio while he's deep in preparations for the Musk case. He said it's against the advice of his friends and family. "Every case I've had has to do with upholding the rights of creators. The fact that I make a good living at it, that doesn't mean that I'm still not doing that, because I am doing that." The contradiction, if there is one, Toberoff has never really explained. Maybe there's nothing to explain. Maybe he's already won. Here's the March 2026 cover story with love, Margaret. Margaret Qualley has made her own name in the family business thanks to breakout roles in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and The Substance. Now with the dog stars on the horizon, she presides over an adoring corner of the internet, where the fandom fawns over everything from her marriage to Jack Antonoff to the slight gap between her teeth. But she didn't really want to talk to Marissa Meltzer about any of this at first. Photographs for this article by Dan Jackson, assisted by fashion editor Carlene Cerf de Duzile. Margaret Qualley walks into Clark's, a diner in Brooklyn Heights, carrying her little dog Smokey in her arms, and immediately intercepted by an employee who tells her she can't have a dog inside. "I'll be back in 10 minutes," is the first thing she says. She lives nearby with her husband, the musician and producer Jack Antonoff. "I suggest taking a walk. Do you want to just come over?" she asks. I had wondered what the actor who so often portrays an unassuming allure would be like, stripped of the mediation of the screen. But I can tell as the words are coming out of her mouth, she's already changing her mind about having a writer see the inside of her home. "I can have my husband meet me downstairs. It's a mess." When Qualley returns, she appears effortless. She's wearing a hoodie and Uggs and orders hot water with lemon. She seems reluctant to talk about her relationship with Antonoff, whom she met at a party in 2021, other than saying, "I've always been very love-oriented. I've always been looking for my person, and I met Jack." They wed in the summer of 2023 on Long Beach Island, New Jersey, where they have a home. The area was mobbed with fans looking for a glimpse of Taylor Swift, who attended, along with Channing Tatum, Zoe Kravitz, and Cara Delevingne. Qualley wore a Chanel dress and flats and danced all night. She also doesn't wish to share anecdotes about any of those bold-faced, fairly private guests, such as Lana Del Rey, who sang at the wedding, or Del Rey's own wedding, which she attended. "Will Qualley and Antonoff have kids?" "Yeah, for sure," she says. I jokingly ask if she has names chosen. "If I did, I wouldn't talk about it," she says. She's similarly circumspect on the topic of her mother, the actor Andy McDowell, the Groundhog Day and Four Weddings and a Funeral star, who appeared on 2 Vanity Fair covers before Qualley was born. "She gives me little nuggets of advice," she says. "On what?" she trails off. Qualley is a good actor, but not so talented that she can hide her reluctance to talk about McDowell. "I didn't even get into her past relationships with Shia LaBeouf and Pete Davidson, as she was already squirming visibly." She understands our collective curiosity, even if she doesn't love being the focus of it. "I do not look down on gossip," she says. "I think gossip is cavemen. Gossip is survival." Her social life is visible enough that when photos behind the making of Kendrick Lamar's GNX album were published, Antonoff was shown in the studio, and Qualley could be seen hanging out. She looks like a fun person to be friends with, but she is also a sort of forceful body, the kind that fuels the life of an omnivorously creative celebrity but stops short of being a regular on Page Six. Perhaps she wants to be a household name with boundaries, or treated more like a renowned male actor of the Leonardo DiCaprio blueprint. For now, Qualley is content to pursue a high-wire act of keeping her personal life unexplored and remains an enigma to the public. "I don't feel like I'm always good at representing myself publicly in real time, so I would almost rather say nothing at all, because rather than have the wrong idea about me, someone just wouldn't have any idea about me," she wrote later in a text message. Her ability to withdraw is enabled by the fact that she has the kind of face you can project a lot of ideas and assumptions onto. With big round doll eyes and real person teeth, fair skin, dark hair, full lips, and the lithe body of the dancer she is, she looks like a lanky version of Snow White. At age 31, she has been cast as an ingenue for 10 years, an archetype of a woman exploring innocence and experience that matches her exterior. But she has become a critical darling, not just for her look, but the physical commitment and psychological remove that's apparent in the roles she chooses. Qualley first gained traction on successful series such as The Leftovers, Maid, and Fosse Verdon. She took smaller but showy roles with auteur directions, such as an art student cum straight-talking muse in Richard Linklater's Blue Moon, a wayward hippie who joins the Manson family in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a stunted woman-child in Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things, a journalist in Claire Denis's Stars at Noon, and for two Ethan Coen capers, a queer private investigator in Honey Don't, and a woman in possession of a mysterious briefcase in Drive Away Dolls. In 2024, Qualley stepped into full-blown movie stardom with the darkly comic body horror The Substance, playing a younger, souped-up version of Demi Moore. The Substance was really intense, she says. In a good way or a bad way? Both. She instantly loved the script. It read like an animated feature. And not just that, but she understood the literalization of the horrors of aging and pressure to be pretty. I feel hot for like 3 days a month, she quips. She's talking about ovulating. One thing Qualley has always had going for her, which belies a zaniness that has made her stand out from her cohort of young actors, is her affinity for side projects that dip into the delightfully odd. She danced her way through a Kinzo World short film shot by Spike Jones, making a long advertisement for perfume into something actually memorable. She co-starred in another for Chanel, a house she has long had a relationship with, playing the girlfriend of A$AP Rocky, who goes about her life in New York with the wonder and strange reality that director Michael Gondry can conjure. She has performed in a James Bond tribute at the Oscars and joined All Fours author and director Miranda July in an online performance piece about physical longing. And now that she has overcome her caginess, she is learning to crack herself open. Qualley has seen what the Hollywood machine can do. Her parents, McDowell, the actor, and father Paul Qualley, who was a model, divorced in 1999. Her father later moved to Panama with her mother, while her mother continued to make movies. Even from their childhood perch in Montana and later the college town Asheville, North Carolina, Qualley and her siblings embraced the spotlight to different degrees. Her sister Rainey is a musician, and her brother Justin has done a good job of staying under the radar. Still, the three Qualley siblings remain very close, and based on photos of the children's weddings, McDowell and the senior Qualley seem like committed co-parents. In some sense, she had a normal childhood, complete with classic Southern tropes of loving grits and sweet tea and hanging out at Waffle House. Much of her early years were spent in the world of competitive dancing, jazz and modern, along the lines of Dance Moms. She can still do an aerial, which is like a cartwheel without hands. For high school, she left home to go to boarding school at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. In those days, she still went by Sarah Margaret, her given name, and the name many members of her family and old friends still call her. The competitive dance side stayed with her and in many ways informs the actor she is today. I remember a teacher saying to me in front of everyone, "You're dancing like a peacock when you should be dancing like a pigeon," she recalls. I think I interpreted that as I'm physically asking for too much attention. She was not, essentially, doing what young dancers were expected to do, blend in. At 16, Qualley moved to New York City and quit dancing. She lived in a series of downtown apartments and modeled for IMG, including for Chanel. By her early 20s, Qualley says, "I was controlling my body, and my body had control over me. I must go to sleep now, must wake up now, must work out now." She was auditioning for acting roles and lived a highly disciplined and regimented life. Why she acts or how she does it, she has a hard time putting into words. Acting is kind of like magic, and magic stops being magical if you try to explain it, she says. There is a French phrase, l'esprit d'escalier, for remembering the right thing to say only after the fact. Quali, who often has an easier time finding her words later, is the kind of person the phrase was made for. Like so many young women, let alone ones leading public lives, she is struggling to figure out how and in which ways to take up space and when to hide behind blending in. In a text, she writes, I love my job. I love being alive, and I love how alive I feel when I'm acting. Jacob Elordi, Quali's co-star in the upcoming Ridley Scott movie, The Dog Stars, an adaptation of Peter Heller's prescient 2012 novel about people surviving after an infectious disease kills 99% of the population, which is currently slated for an August release, tried to sum up her talent. In an email he wrote, Margaret Qualley keeps it real. It's a requirement. A genuine pleasure to work with an artist like that. She demands the truth. She also reminded me how important it is to stay limber. I ask Qualley if he is talking about being literally physically limber or something more symbolic. I hope it's a dual meaning, she says with a laugh. Her Blue Moon director, Linklater, thinks that Margaret's secret sauce is that dancing background, her unique movement and physicality. There is something elegant in her. She's a master of her own body. But what impressed him the most was her work ethic. She was ready to work, and that's all we did. We rehearsed every weekend for weeks. Some actors resent that, like, don't tell me what to do. But she was on a journey to find this character. He points to a scene near the end of the film where Quali's character, a wise at 20 years old Yale student, delivers a nearly 10-minute monologue to Lauren's Hart's washed-up, semi-closeted lyricist, played by Ethan Hawke. Margaret contributed quite a bit to the spirit of it. She made it very clear as a woman who had had guys falling in love with her whole life, this idea of I love you, just not in that way. That's the death blow of the movie, and she knew that feeling so damn well. Hawke has been thinking about the burden of being a young female actor. His own daughter, the Stranger Things actor Maya Hawke, is a friend of Qualley's. Whenever someone is an ingenue, you think, he pauses, Margaret is not what you imagine. She's a spitfire and funny and inappropriate in the best ways. He would like to see her take Katharine Hepburn-style roles with the same intensity and strength and humor. She's been through a lot. She's a serious young woman. She sees through a lot. She's not desperate to please in a way that's really charming. I have met a lot of young ingenues who are afraid that if they work too much, something will be revealed. Aubrey Plaza, who was in Honey Don't with Qualley, would also like to see her lean into female comedy. She does a lot of intense movies, and she's so gorgeous and has asked so much as an ingenue, but she has got such a fun, childlike energy about her, just doesn't have an ego. She's not afraid to humiliate herself or be weird, she says, relating to the knowingness that Hawke sees in Qualley. According to Plaza, they are both introverted extroverts who work hard and then want to go home. Between takes, Qualley and Plaza would power walk up and down the street or roll around on the floor to keep their energy up. It is apt that Plaza, who has always projected such a dry, cunning humor that she has never played the innocent, sees the places Qualley could go. Her co-workers vouch for a humor and a warmth that Qualley herself struggles to communicate to non-actors, or at least to strangers like me. Plaza explains that movie sets are the kind of place where you can feel like you've forged a bond with someone for life, and then never see them again after shooting. This is not the case with Qualley. I met her at a hard time for me, and she's there, We don't get to be physically together a lot because of our schedules, but she'll check in on me. I'm the kind of person where I don't reach out when things are hard, and she was very good about reaching out and keeping in touch and asking me how I am. Even when she's in the throes of shooting a million movies in London or Italy, she will call to ask me how I am. Being a woman as beautiful as Quali, who is so convincing as muses and innocence, can mean that Hollywood, and maybe the whole world, never really gives you the benefit of an inner life. It's hard to feel comfortable with translating your interiority when people connect so fiercely with your outer adorned self. After encountering Quali at the Brooklyn Diner and interviewing her co-stars, and after she admits to being guarded in our first meeting, I get a text from her with a kind of manifesto about life. I love my husband, my family. I love dancing and horses. I love the moon. Happy crying is the best. I love listening to Tara Brach and books on tape and anything Jack writes. Female friendships are so holy. Shout out Talia Ryder. My sister was my first soulmate. I want to die on a farm. I need to learn how to drive stick. My brother tried to teach me, but I was 12 and it didn't land. Smokey, dog, God, I love you, world. Thank you for having me. The whole monologue feels big-hearted, a little dramatic, and not one bit jaded. It's authentically Margaret Qualley in her shaggy truth. It's also the person that Plaza says she knows, a woman who will keep in touch and check in, even after her time on set or obligatory few hours in a restaurant with a journalist is over. I explain that that is the person I would have rather met at the diner. She doesn't have to talk about her mother or husband or Taylor Swift, despite the public's and my own deep and obvious interest, but surely there has to be some topic she is willing to open up about in earnest. So 3 weeks later, we reconvene at the bar at Chez Nous in Greenwich Village, this time with Smokey, a journal, and a list of notes on her phone of points she would like to make. She is once again dressed casually in an oversized sweater with her hair swept up. It's busy, but no one seems to notice or recognize her. She orders a Cabernet Sauvignon. She has been thinking a lot about the kind of femininity she wants to embrace in the future, perhaps inspired by the substance, perhaps by getting older. I started working so young, and when I first started acting, I was just overwhelmed. I felt like I was fully myself. I felt like if I was fully myself, women would hate me and men would hurt me. And so that took away some of the tools that come with being a woman because I was scared. Gradually, now that I feel like I have more control of my life, I can kind of lean more into the sensual and the feminine, she says. Jack has helped me for sure, because he has made me feel more confident to explore all the parts of myself. But I'm also thinking about Mother Earth and the divine feminine and surrender. Those are the things I'm trying to lean into that moment in my life. Surrender is a word she repeats in her head as a reminder, as are the ideas of pace and slowness. They are not things that come naturally to her. Not physically as a dancer who knows how to push her body, and not as an actor with ambition. I'm super competitive with myself, and I'm very driven, she says. I have learned the lesson of my eyes being too big for my stomach professionally. That means taking all the opportunities I can get, and then crashing, and feeling like I have a schedule I can't keep up with. She's taken on roles she thinks were mistakes. When I say mistakes, I don't mean it was the wrong thing. I mean I wouldn't do it again. Quali is choosier about her projects now, both because she's learned to be and because she's earned it. In The Dog Stars, Quali will play Seema, short for Cimarron, and describes making the film as a different scale of filmmaking than I'm used to. It's also a different kind of part. One of a fully grown woman who has loved and lost, seen it all, and somehow is moving forward. In the future, she'd like to take on roles that explore her own darkness. She now thinks of filming a movie as one long meditation. She is a faithful student of twice-a-day transcendental meditation. I used to use my job as an excuse to check out of my life. I find that now staying checked into my life is the best medicine. That idea of relentlessly staying in the present reminds me of what her colleagues like about her. How Elordi said she reminds him to stay limber, and Plaza praised her for keeping in touch. When she finds out I teach restorative yoga, she takes my number for a class and invites me over to instruct her at her in-home dance studio. Quali is exercising the discernment and workmanship that she's honed in her acting, but this time it's meant to communicate that she didn't quit on me or this project of getting to know each other, even when she wasn't obligated to ever see me again. A few days later, a bouquet of 2 dozen pink roses arrives at my desk. She's not afraid to wield her considerable charm. Back at Chez Nous, Quali is about to leave to meet her husband nearby at Electric Lady Studios, but first has a story. She recalls speaking to a woman, a French osteopath, who was the kind of wise and witchy person who can give all manner of advice. "I thought," she said, "you have to have passion," and I was like, "I do." "But really," she said, "patience." And I thought, okay, that misunderstanding really encapsulates effing everything. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.